Chapter 3 of Living Ethically. Sexual Relationships. The third precept, Kame Su Michachara Verimini, is to abstain from sexual misconduct. Forsaking the wives of others, which is how Nagarjuna refers to this precept, is therefore the very least that a male practitioner of the Dharma should expect from himself. The masculine perspective is here taken as for granted because the text is addressed to a king. Furthermore, in ancient India, a man's wife was considered to be his property, and the traditional interpretation reflects this belief. The precept was also seen as covering abstention from the violation or abduction of any woman, married or unmarried, and this was again in large part a matter of respecting the property of other men, inasmuch as a daughter or sister, however mature, literally belonged to her family until she joined another family through marriage. Until then, she was under the protection of her father and her brothers. Moving from history to modern practicalities, it is clear how the third precept is to be applied today, whether by women or by men. Two main principles seem to be involved. First, one should not violate another person's individuality by using them for one's sexual gratification against their wishes. Second, inasmuch as someone is regarded as belonging to their sexual partner, knowingly breaking up a marriage or other sexual partnership is a form of taking the not given, as well as being a case of violating the individuality of the person whose partner one has stolen, in inverted commas. But if we limit our sexual activity to what is socially acceptable, can we leave it at that? Is this simple criterion enough? It is if a rule is all that you want. It isn't, though, if you want to make the observance of the precept a real ethical practice. I once saw the precepts written up on a board in a vihara, a Buddhist monastery, in London, and the third one was not to indulge in wicked love. The monks obviously wanted people to think about this precept a bit more deeply. But how does someone practice the third precept if they are married and simply don't have the time or the inclination to indulge in wicked love in any case? Not to misbehave with other people's partners does not exhaust the implications of this precept. For a start, we should clear away a lot of the rationalising and romanticising that serves to idealise, even spiritualise, sexual activity. We like to imagine that sex is all about giving and sharing, but is this really the case? If we are honest with ourselves, can we say that the tremendous attraction we feel towards another person is really just an urge to give? I suspect that in the great majority of cases, sexual relationships are nicely judged reciprocal arrangements, balanced exchanges of services, physical and emotional, healthy enough on their own level, but not to be elevated above that level. Should one try to elevate them in this way, one is inevitably going to be disappointed or even resentful when those services are no longer being offered quite so freely or when they are withdrawn altogether. Then there is the question of mindfulness. What is the real effect of sexual activity upon one's state of mind? It is worth taking the trouble to notice this if one is attempting to combine a spiritual life with sexual activity. No doubt tantric adepts and advanced bodhisattva yogis can incorporate sexual activity into their spiritual practice, but we have to ask ourselves if we are really anywhere near that level. It's not as if an occasional lapse of mindfulness is going to put a stop to our spiritual life. Lapses are inevitable. Even after years of practice, instinctual urges and old tendencies may emerge from time to time and result in a temporary setback in our overall spiritual progress, and there's no point in getting caught up in self-recrimination. What is spiritually incapacitating is self-deception. Furthermore, making allowance for natural drives is not to be confused with the view that a healthy person needs sex and that we are repressed or deprived if we do not get it. Unfortunately, the assumption that sexual innocence or purity somehow blocks the healthy functioning of the individual is widely accepted. From this comes the curious idea that one needs to accumulate a lot of worldly experience in the form of personal difficulties and messy sexual relationships to be mature enough to embark upon the spiritual life. There is almost a stigma attached to having to admit that one hasn't had sex for months or years at a time, as though that made one unattractive, a failure, even not quite a real man or a real woman. This is a very pervasive, Mitchaditi, wrong view these days, but it is certainly not the traditional view either in the West or in the East. The mistaken assumption underpinning it is that the same rules can be applied to everyone, but people are different. There are many things that are important to one person, but are of no consequence to another. Some people can't live without sex, while others get by quite happily without it, at least so long as they're not constantly being told that they must surely be unhappy. People who are temperamentally inclined to chastity, perhaps as a result of very positive karma, may come to the spiritual life innocent and pure and make considerable progress. Perhaps they have a gift for chastity. If so, they should be allowed to enjoy that gift, not be pushed against the healthy and refined grain of their true nature into seeking the kind of experience that most of us feel we cannot live without. Those of us who are not so gifted should allow ourselves an outlet for our sexual urges without undermining the confidence of those who can practice the Dharma happily without the need for sex. Why not rejoice in purity and innocence as a virtue and a blessing, even if the rest of society takes a completely different view? The third precept is concerned with what we do with our sexuality in the broadest sense. It's not just about sexual relationships. It is also concerned with how we use our sexuality in order to achieve other objects, as when we charm people in order to get what we want. There is an unpleasant mixture of mutual exploitation and deception in much of what we accept as normal social intercourse between the sexes. This precept is therefore also about being aware of a certain kind of power or energy that is available to us, and of the part it plays in the half-conscious flirtation that creeps into so much of our communication. We should respond to people with real friendliness and metta, but not get caught up in the kind of exchange that stirs up sexual feelings in a thoughtless way. Along with this unconscious misuse of sexuality, there often goes a fear of experiencing sexual feelings, particularly when those feelings have for their object a person of the same sex as oneself. This is not to say that such feelings have to be acted upon, but sexual feelings cannot be kept in a sealed box apart from all one's other emotions. Our sexuality, for good or ill, seeps into all sorts of situations in which we would nevertheless not want to express it, and the danger is that we become afraid even to acknowledge the presence of this element of our experience. An unconscious fear of experiencing supposedly unacceptable sexual feelings sometimes prevents people from acknowledging and expressing normal feelings of attraction or affection. Being emotionally drawn to someone is automatically identified as a sexual feeling when it might not be anything of the kind. In this way, quite positive feelings can be replaced by emotional unease, by inhibition, and consequently by loss of energy. We need to be able to feel strong, warm emotions in connection with our sexuality, but we need also to be able to experience strong, warm emotions without sexual feelings being involved at all. If it is difficult for you to separate such emotions from sex, this doesn't mean that it's a good idea to repress the sexual feelings and take up a life of strict celibacy. Should you do so, those feelings will almost certainly emerge later in life and then be more difficult to handle. Conversely, the more freely we are able to express positive emotion, the better we will be able to deal with our biological or instinctual urges. Quote, "Lust for a woman mostly comes from thinking that her body is clean, but there is nothing clean in a woman's body, in fact. The abdomen and chest is a vessel of feces, urine, lungs, liver, and so forth. Those who through obscuration do not see a woman this way lust for her body. There is pleasure when a sore is scratched, but to be without sores is more pleasurable still. Just so, there are pleasures in worldly desires, but to be without desires is more pleasurable still. If you analyse thus, even though you do not achieve freedom from desire, because your desire has lessened, you will not lust for women." End quote. In his advice to the king, Nagarjuna finds it necessary to devote over 20 verses, only 4 of which are quoted here, to curbing the male reader's sexual appetite. Why? Let us first look at the argument. We are used to washing off all the various secretions and excretions of our own body, and yet we go into paroxysms of desire over the unclean body of another. There is something absurd, Nagarjuna is suggesting, about such a situation. Similarly, there is a certain intense satisfaction to be gained from scratching an itching sore. Yet no one who knew what it was like to be free of that terrible itch would willingly have it back. The majority of teachings of this sort are addressed to men, but similar views about the body are found in the Theragata, the enlightenment verses of the early Buddhist nuns. The corresponding reflections recommended for the nuns to help wean them from their attachment to men are less concerned with the repulsiveness of the body. At that time, at least, they seem to have been attracted less by men's physical attributes and more by their apparent trustworthiness, so those verses make much of how treacherous and faithless, how disloyal and deceitful men can be, how you cannot trust their sweet words, how they say one thing and mean another, and how they will betray your trust even as they gaze lovingly into your eyes. Their verses focus on the fact that it is the nature of men to be unfaithful and to lust after other women. This harsh view of the male sex is probably quite acceptable to many people today. But the attitude towards women's body that we find in the present verses runs right against the grain of modern sensibilities. Probably most people would consider the systematic cultivation of this way of thinking about the female body as morbid, unpleasant, and negative. Looked at superficially, these verses and other Buddhist texts like them may seem to represent a powerfully misogynistic strain running through the Buddhist tradition. They seem to put women down, but they are in fact not intended as an objective assessment of women. They have to be seen as pertaining to method rather than to doctrine, the method in this case being that of a means to help men overcome their sexual craving. The problems that people have with verses like these stem, I would say, from the quite different nature of the major obstacles faced in the spiritual life by men and by women. These obstacles are more to do with identity than with sex itself. Nowadays, men seem to find giving up sex a real problem, representing, as this does, a loss of an important part of their masculine identity. However, this identity is forged largely by male competitiveness in the workplace, and men probably start to make more spiritual progress when they wholeheartedly give up worldly ambition rather than when they give up sex. It would seem that a woman's difficulty with celibacy is also less to do with sex itself and more to do with her identity as a woman. In her case, it seems to be more to do with losing the emotional intimacy that goes with sex and with losing, ultimately, the possibility of her being a wife and mother. The adoption of a celibate lifestyle thus represents for her a tremendous step in itself. The question of children in particular, while it may have become less important for most men than it was in the past, remains comparatively important for women. The Sanskrit term to which Nagarjuna is making reference in these verses is shubha, which is here translated as clean, while the negative form ashubha is translated as filthy, although these terms can also be translated as meaning pure and impure, as lovely and unlovely. Ashubha is often associated with the three lakshanas, or characteristics of conditioned existence. According to Buddhist teaching, conditioned existence is dukkha, unsatisfactory, anicca, impermanent, and anatman, without a substantial, unchanging self. Sometimes ashubha is added to this list. When this is done, and the four are seen in the opposite way, they become the four viparyashas, the mental perversities or topsy-turvy views. Being ourselves conditioned, we cannot help ascribing what are in fact the characteristics of the unconditioned to conditioned existence. We see the world not as unsatisfactory, but as sukha or pleasant. When we possess things, we think we will always have them. That is, we see conditioned existence not as impermanent, but as nitya or permanent. We also see it not as devoid of permanent unchanging selfhood, but as possessed of such selfhood or atman. Finally, we see the objects of our craving not as ashubha, but as being attractive and lovely. In these verses, Nagarjuna focuses on that aspect of conditioned existence to which we most easily and regularly ascribe the qualities of loveliness and purity that really belong to the unconditioned, the body of a person with whom we are infatuated. After all, we don't fall in love with trees, for example, beautiful as they may be. We don't get so attached to a particular tree that we want to spend all our time with it and eventually move in with it. Our craving casts a sort of glamour over the bodies of certain people, a glamour that does not gather around any other object, however beautiful. Therefore, serious Buddhist practitioners have always been advised to practice the ashubha bhavana, the contemplation of the less pleasant aspects of the human body. Just as we meditate on the impermanence and insubstantiality of conditioned existence, and on the lack of real satisfaction to be found in it, so we can also meditate on the unattractiveness, ashubha, of conditioned existence. In this practice, we focus on certain aspects of the human body, aspects which we would normally find unpleasant, but whose unpleasantness we disregard when we are in the grip of sexual passion. The Ashupa Bhavana helps to expose how lust can override our natural repugnance for the secretions and excretions of other people's bodies. One tries to see the human body as it really is, impermanent, unsatisfactory, without fixed selfhood, and in truth unlovely. Buddhist practice involves the cultivation of awareness, but sexual craving, on account of its blind instinctual nature, takes us in the opposite direction. To prevent this from happening, drastic action is needed. And this is what we get in these verses. Nagarjuna is not necessarily hoping to free the king from sexual desire altogether. He may just be trying to help him to arrive at a degree of awareness. It's as if he is saying, "Wake up. Take a closer look at this object of your craving. What is it really like?" His invitation to examine the charms of the flesh with a critical eye perhaps also reflects a thought that at least occasionally crosses the minds of most people when they are engaged in pursuit of someone, or even when they finally achieve an intimate embrace with him or her. Perhaps the first few times you really are exploring the world of pleasurable human experience. But after that, you might not be able to help thinking, "Well, here we go again." You know more or less what's going to happen and you wonder, "Is it really worth doing? What is the point? What am I getting out of this? How much am I even enjoying it?" Yet, despite such misgivings, you feel somehow driven to it as if by compulsion. In order to counteract such compulsion, there is an emphasis on celibacy in most forms of Buddhism, celibacy being an indication that the sex drive is under control. The Pali scriptures make it clear that the Buddha was completely celibate, while those who had attained stream entry, the point at which progress towards enlightenment is assured, while not necessarily celibate, were certainly not dominated by their sexual desires. However, in at least one place, the Buddha allows the possibility that someone might enjoy the pleasures of the senses and remain unattached. In the Aripariyasana Sutta, he classifies practitioners into three types. He uses the image of a deer being hunted, but I'm going to use the image of a mouse as I think this makes the point more clearly. There are three kinds of mice. There are those who go after the cheese in the trap unwisely and who are caught. Those who go after the cheese more carefully and who are not caught. And those who stay away from both cheese and trap and who, of course, are not caught. It is interesting that the Buddha did not deny the second possibility, that if you were very mindful, you could nibble at the pleasures of the senses without necessarily being overcome by craving. But this is dangerous. Most people are in fact overcome and suffer the consequences. It's much safer to stay away from the cheese. What Nagarjuna is recommending in the king's case is in principle the second option, which in practice will mean restricting himself to a modest sex life, this being quite compatible with the aim of attaining stream entry. Like celibacy, the Ashubha Bhavana is not an end in itself. Disgust or revulsion towards the body cannot be counted as a positive mental state unless it clears the way, as it's meant to do, for something better. In a sense, its purpose is to help us to distinguish between biological attractiveness and aesthetic beauty. One person might have conventional good looks and yet lack any real beauty, while another might be without any obvious attractions and yet be truly beautiful. Shubha, the term used in this context, means pure as well as beautiful. It denotes a kind of spiritual beauty in the Neoplatonic sense. The same kind of beauty is being referred to at the very beginning of the precious garland, when Nagarjuna extols the Buddha as adorned with all good qualities. The challenge for artists down the centuries has been to paint works that would appeal to their public's taste for sensuous beauty, while aiming at the same time to achieve a more innocent vision, an impression of pure beauty, for those who were capable of enjoying it. Even the greatest artists may not always be appreciated for this higher achievement. It is said that at the end of the Second World War, two British soldiers were going round the Uffizi Gallery in Florence and came upon Botticelli's The Birth of Venus. "Oi, come and look at this, Bill," said one. "There's a girl here with no clothes on and two blokes spitting at her." End quote. Clearly, beauty isn't necessarily inherent in the object of our perception. It also depends on our looking at it in a certain way. If we look at it with greed or lust, then what we see is something sensuously attractive. If we look at it contemplatively, with metta, then we see something rather different, something possessing beauty. The Buddha remarks more than once in the Pali scriptures that a sign or characteristic of metta is that you see things as beautiful, shubha. This is because the key element in both shubha and metta, which raises them above ordinary human emotion, is disinterested awareness. Schopenhauer emphasized this characteristic of aesthetic appreciation, that it is a pure delight in the object for its own sake, without any desire to make use of it. What he calls the will, a striving, yearning force, is temporarily suspended. If you find what you see sensuously attractive, you will probably want to grab it for the sake of your own pleasure. But if you find it aesthetically beautiful, you will just want to stand back and contemplate it, surrender to it, absorb yourself in it. Aesthetic contemplation is therefore not only disinterested, but in a way impersonal. You lose yourself in the object, forgetting your personal concerns. Thus it is equivalent to the experience of the first jhana, the first level of meditative absorption. This is the kind of vision for which the Ashubha Bhavana prepares us. Once we have established some initial control over our unskillful reactions to conditioned things, we can begin to reflect on the beauty of the unconditioned. The Ashubha Bhavana helps us to stand back from the object of sensuous desire, to inhibit the impulse to reach out and grasp it, whether literally or mentally. To the extent that we can do this, to that extent we will be able to see things as purely beautiful. Seeing the unloveliness of conditioned existence prepares us to see the beauty that lies beyond it. Conversely, it is difficult to redirect one's desire towards the unconditioned so long as one imagines that one has found perfect beauty in a particular human form. The positive approach to craving, raising one's gaze from grosser to more refined objects of desire, will be helpful at some point, but a vigorously negative approach is usually necessary to begin with. Whether everyone could benefit from this approach is another matter. Whereas the Indians of Nagarjuna's time apparently had a full-blooded and guilt-free relish for worldly pleasures, many in the post-Christian West are still burdened with a vague sense of the sinfulness of sexual pleasure. For us, sex is not quite such a straightforward matter as it seems to have been in ancient India. Someone might therefore take up the Ashubha Bhavana with an enthusiasm that came from a rather unhealthy, inhibited, or otherwise negative attitude to their body and their sexuality. In their case, the practice might serve only to reinforce their unhealthy attitude. I would therefore not prescribe the Ashubha Bhavana for very many people in our culture today. Nagarjuna's advice was offered at a specific time to a particular person. If he were alive today, he would no doubt express himself in a way that addressed modern problems and preoccupations. For example, he might have thought that a romantic emotional attachment to a particular person in some way laid deeper snares for the practitioner than sexual desire itself. The processes that underlie such attachments have been investigated by modern psychology. According to Buddhism, we have within us various positive potentials. I'll start that sentence again. According to Buddhism, we have within us various positive potentials. We are not always conscious of them, however, and we therefore tend to project them, as the psychologists would say, onto objects outside ourselves. We project our spiritual potential, for example, onto a guru figure. And if we lack confidence, we may project that quality onto someone who appears to possess it. Of course, it's not easy to tell whether one is projecting a positive quality or whether one is simply appreciating its presence in another person in a healthy way. We can be reasonably certain that we will tend to project certain qualities onto those to whom we are sexually attracted. It is as though we were conscious of being somehow incomplete, and that instead of trying to develop what was lacking, we look for it in another person, usually someone of the opposite sex. Married people often refer to their spouse as their better half. This is why people sometimes experience panic and terror when a relationship breaks up. It is as though you were losing far more than just another person. It can feel as though half of you was being torn away. But this is an illusion. The other person is not our other half, as we soon discover if we happen to come into conflict with them. And if a relationship becomes a way of avoiding the task of developing the qualities we believe are possessed by the other person, then it is clearly an unhelpful one. Having said all this, projection may be initially useful in that it enables one to have, through contact with another person, some experience of one's unintegrated qualities. In the case of men, it is their unrealised feminine qualities that tend to get projected onto their partner in a romantic relationships. Their potential, gentleness, sympathy, and receptivity. Because one does not experience certain qualities in oneself, in the sense of not having integrated them into one's conscious being, one is unconsciously drawn to finding them outside oneself. Most people seem to go through this stage of romantic projection, usually in adolescence, and some go on repeating the experience again and again. But if you're relatively healthy, psychologically speaking, and fairly aware, you can learn to withdraw such projections without too much difficulty and without disrupting your relationship with the other person. All this can be a normal part of growing up. As a result of falling out of love and possibly breaking up with your partner, you will develop almost naturally a more mature character. It is possible to work with our projections even within a close relationship. We just need to ask ourselves, what do I really see in this person? Once we recognise what it is, we know what we need to look for within ourselves. We can also ask ourselves how we feel in the loved person's absence. This is usually a good indication of how far the projection has progressed. When they're not there, do we feel that we ourselves are not really or fully there either, or that we are somehow lost or helpless? If so, clearly something is missing. It is not just the other person that's missing, but a quality that we've got used to having available to us through them, a quality we experience as being outside rather than within us. Such projection is quite different from appreciating in someone else qualities that we know we ourselves do not possess. We will be pleased to have that person around, and when they're not there, we might miss them, but we won't feel that we're being deprived of our very soul. It is painful when a partner walks out on us, but this is a moment that provides an opportunity to see something about ourselves that perhaps we could not have seen in any other way. Now at last we're forced to face the inner lack that this person's presence in our life prevented us from seeing before. Even though we might look around for a substitute to fill the gap, the period of painful awareness into which we have been plunged may enable us to look with more open eyes at the unconscious processes that have been going on. To conclude, the contemplation of the ugliness of the conditioned needs to be balanced by the contemplation of the purely beautiful. We need the stick and the carrot. I would suggest only that the carrot should be carefully chosen. In some circles, it seems to be regarded as old-fashioned to look for beauty in the arts, but perhaps this is due to a confusion between true beauty and the merely pretty and decorative. Though one might react against the Victorian weakness for the picturesque and the sentimental, this is not a reason for turning one's back on what is truly beautiful, whether in art or in nature. Many years ago, I got to know a film producer in Bombay who, despite his busy and glamorous life, was quite thoughtful. He once visited the Ajanta Caves to look for a film location, and on his return he had a question for me. He had been impressed, he said, by the beauty of the cave paintings, but one thing puzzled him. He had noticed that there were not only paintings of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and of animals and plants, but also of half-naked women. Why, he asked, had the monks who lived there, whose lives were dedicated to the practice of renunciation, depicted such images on the walls of their dwellings? I'd not considered this question before, but the answer that immediately came to me was that the monks must have regarded the bodies of women as being simply part of the natural world, and that they were, as such, to be appreciated, like other beautiful objects. They saw them aesthetically, not with desire, just as they saw fruit and flowers. One Buddhist approach is to reject these objects of craving altogether, and to persuade oneself that they aren't really quite so attractive after all. But perhaps aesthetic appreciation provides a middle way between complete rejection of craving and complete abandonment of oneself to it. This, it seems to me, is the ideal solution to the problem of sexual craving, and one that is well within the capacity of the serious Buddhist. The implication here is that we need to derive pleasure from life, even, indeed especially, from a life of renunciation. There is not much point in steering clear of sexual involvements if you are unable to find pleasure anywhere else. If you find your spiritual practice a difficult, painful struggle, and your only enjoyments are crude, sensual ones, you have a problem. A simple solution is to find enjoyment in meditation. Don't take pride in undertaking marathon sessions for their own sake. A 20-minute meditation that you enjoy is better than an hour's meditation that you do only because it's supposed to be good for you. Look for a natural momentum to take you deeper, beyond the imposed discipline that may have been necessary at the beginning. Broaden the scope of your interests to include innocent recreations that you can share with friends, especially spiritual friends. Let at least some of the skillful things you do be enjoyable. A Buddhist should be a walking paradox in the eyes of the world. He or she should be obviously happy even in the absence of financial security, social status, luxury consumer goods, or a sexual relationship, all of which are commonly regarded as being essential to human happiness. The sight of such a person would make people wonder, how can this be? Perhaps my ideas about life are not the whole story. It is what a Buddhist is that speaks to people, far more than clever presentations of Buddhist doctrine. It is where you look for your happiness and satisfaction, much more than what you talk about, that tells people who you really are and what you stand for. Try bringing an aesthetically appreciative rather than a utilitarian attitude to your experience. Obviously, we shouldn't just make use of others. We should try to shake off the attitude that sees attractive people, for example, as being simply objects of desire, underlying which is a view of people and the world around us as having value only as they contribute to our own enjoyment or advantage. The aesthetic attitude is one that sees everything, including other people, with a warm and clear awareness and appreciates things just as they are, without thinking how they could be improved or put to some use. It is akin to the contemplative attitude of resting in pure awareness, without experiencing either desire or aversion. This certainly requires mindfulness, but it is a practice that will reduce the pressure of craving and leave you feeling more at ease. End of chapter 3.